We are almost to the year-end study, so that's exciting. We're going to work on Daniel and try to do what we can to finish Ezekiel. So I think those studies will be helpful to us, those who can participate. A lot of people from out of town are coming. I've got more than 60 I'm finding places for, and I know there's several dozen that are staying with some of you that have already made their own arrangements or are staying in hotels and Airbnbs and various things. So we ought to have a lot of people that we'll get to know. That's an exciting thing, encouraging thing, to get to know brethren in various places throughout the country. So hopefully you'll be able to join for some of that at least. It's kind of the sort of thing where we can come in and out as we can. I think the Scott Hall will be just an outstanding venue for that. We've looked at it and it looks very good. They've been very helpful and accommodating. So that's encouraging. That's right, just right there in Franklin, very easy to get to. So hopefully that can be something that you can involve yourself with. Feel free to invite others. Even non-Christians can benefit by being in that atmosphere and doing that. So I think it can be something very helpful to us, and I'm excited about that opportunity. I'd like for us to go to Psalm 14 this morning. A long time ago, we had gone through some psalms. I think this is about where we'd gotten to. If I'm repeating one or two, it's okay, and if I skip one or two, it's okay too, but I think this is about right. And Psalm 14, it's brief, but meaningful. It's interesting. You've got some psalms that kind of show up again sometimes in the book of Psalms, and this is one that does. Psalm 53 is very similar to Psalm 14. There's a few change, few differences, but obviously this is something that David had on his heart and prayed essentially the same thing more than once, or spoke essentially the same thing more than once. So he starts out by saying, "The fool has said in his heart, there is no God." Now, a fool in the Bible is basically a wicked person. And I believe this fool is not a fool because of a lack of intellectual ability. This is more a fool because he's made a moral decision to do evil. Sin is foolishness. It's the height of folly. You can never do anything more foolish than to turn away from God. And to call this man who really denies God's existence a fool is kind of cutting to him, because you know how those people are. The people who sort of deny God think they actually are possessed with a greater degree of discernment and understanding than most ordinary people, but the truth is they're fools. In fact, all of us are basically fools apart from God. And we have no ultimate understanding if we don't turn to the Lord, if we don't listen to him. Now this says the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Now being a fool, what he's going to say to himself is going to be according to his nature. You know, we talk like we are. But when it says he says it in his heart, in part I think this is an indication that his choice to believe that there's not a God is not so much an intellectual thing. It's a choice. It's an act of will. It's an act of defiance, really. People think, look at John 3 while I'm talking. People think a lot of times that, well, some people, you know, there's just not enough evidence for them. You know, there's just not enough to help them to believe in God. But I don't think that's the case. In John chapter 3 and verse 19, Jesus said, "This is the judgment, that the light has come into the world, and men love the darkness rather than the light, for their deeds were evil. For everyone who does evil hates the light, and does not come to the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. But he who practices the truth comes to the light, so that his deeds may be manifested as having been wrought in God." Why do people not believe in the light? It's not because, well, you know, they just it's not bright enough. They just can't tell that it's shining. Or they just intellectually, they just weren't able to make that leap of faith. Rather, their deeds are evil. They don't want to be close to the light because they're afraid they'll be exposed. They are sort of repelled by the light. Jesus' righteousness and truth is something they don't like. They don't want. So really, this is not some sincere, misguided conviction, but this is just their rebellion against God. They've chosen in their heart not to believe in God. Now, they may not say it publicly. They say it in their heart, it says here. But you think about, if the person who publicly affirms God but says in his heart there's no God is a fool, what about the one who actually says it out loud so that everybody can hear it? That's even more foolish. He seems to be speaking here not so much about a philosophical atheism as a practical atheism. There are people who, you know, just are out and out atheists. They absolutely deny it with every fiber of their being there's a God, but there's a whole lot of people who act like there's no God, who they live and they say to themselves things that make them think they're not going to be accountable to God. That we act like, we behave like there's no God we're going to have to answer to. We live as if there's no God. I think that's what he's more talking about here. But you can, you know, act like there's no God. You can defy God. You can proclaim there's no God. It's not going to change anything. No matter what we say about God, God is there and he's going to judge us. It's like you can deny that fire exists. But if you get too close to it, it'll burn you. Whether you believe in it or not doesn't really matter. We often convince ourselves of what we want to be that so. So the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have committed abominable deeds. Now that's not a surprise, right? Because bad principles lead to bad lives. You know, if we don't really avow God, if we don't really accept God, what are we going to do? We're going to do godless things. We're not going to have a moral principle to guide our behavior. So it's not surprising that they're corrupt. It's not surprising they commit abominable deeds. When we don't live with an awareness of God and a conviction about God, then what we do is going to be terrible. It's going to be abominable. It's going to be corrupt. Our morality comes from our view of God. And so we'll see two basic things that these people do. They defy God's law, and they oppress God's people. Here we're talking about them defying God's law. They become corrupt. He says, there is no one who does good. The Lord has looked down from heaven upon the sons of men, to see if there are any who understand to seek after God. They have all turned aside. Together they become corrupt. There is no one who does good, not even one. Now, if you've been reading those first couple of lines, you probably weren't prepared for this. What he ends up saying is a pretty staggering conclusion. He says, everybody's in the same boat. There's no one who does good, not even one. They do bad, and they don't do good. And that's the universal record. The statistics are 100% do bad. Humanity is a desert with no oasis. There's nobody who seeks for God. In fact, God was looking for somebody who sought for him, and he doesn't find it. It kind of reminds you of the assessment God made right before the flood in Genesis 6 and verse 5. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And then in verse 11, now the earth was corrupt in the sight of God and the earth was filled with violence. God looked on the earth and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth. Like, everybody is bad. Everybody's corrupt. You think about times in the Bible and the prophets where the prophets were looking for somebody good. Isaiah chapter 59, for example, and verse 4. No one sues righteously and no one pleads honestly. They trust in confusion and speak lies. They conceive mischief and bring forth iniquity. In Jeremiah chapter 5, and verse 1, roam to and fro through the streets of Jerusalem, and look now, and take note, and seek in her open squares, if you can find a man, if there is one who does justice, who who seeks truth, then I will pardon her. Just find one good person, Jeremiah. That's all I'm asking for. And evidently, from the outcome of Jerusalem, he was unable to find that one. In Micah chapter 7 and verse 1, woe is me, for I am like the fruit pickers, like the grape gatherers. There is not a cluster of grapes to eat, or a first ripe fig which I crave. The godly person has perished from the land, and there is no upright person among them. All of them lie in wait for bloodshed. Each of them hunts the other with a net. Everybody's wicked. This is the result of the polling. It's 100% corrupt. So when we look at this, at first, you're thinking, boy, those people who say in their heart there's no God, those are bad guys. Sure, I'm glad I'm not like that. And then he turns it on all of us and says, really, we're all in that same boat. None understand, which of course the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. If we don't fear the Lord, we have no understanding. We've all become corrupt. And so he really indicts the whole human race with being the fool, with acting like there's no God, with doing evil and not doing good. But then look at verse 4, as he says, do all the workers of wickedness not know, who eat up my people as they eat bread and do not call upon the Lord? Now that's rather striking, because we would have assumed from verses 1 to 3 that there were no people of God here. And then suddenly he turns and he says, don't all the workers of wickedness not know, who eat up my people as they eat bread? And he goes on to talk about those that God is a refuge to. So is everybody wicked or not? And I think the answer is, we are all wicked by our record. By God's grace, we can be forgiven and become God's people. Paul uses these verses in 1 through 3 in Romans chapter 3 when he indicts the whole human race of being sinners. When he's showing the universal need for the gospel, that there's nobody exempt from the need for Jesus' sacrifice and for God, Jesus' blood. And so the truth is, we all are sinners. We all fit into the category of 1 through 3, but because Jesus, through his sacrifice, has forgiven us, then there are some who have been redeemed from that state and who are God's people. By God's grace, there are exceptions in that sense. Not that any of us on our own merit are right before God, but that through the grace of God, we can be saved. And so that's the encouraging teaching here. But then, think about what those who don't receive God's grace, how they treat the righteous people. He says, do all the workers of wickedness not know? Who eat up my bread as they eat up my people as they eat bread and do not call upon the Lord. So he's describing these unrighteous people who rebel against God, who have not turned to the Lord to be declared righteous by him through the salvation in Christ. Don't they know? These workers of wickedness who eat up my people as they eat bread. That's kind of an odd way to say that. Eat up my people as they eat bread. Well, think about, can you tell me, we're almost to the end of 2018. How many slices of bread have you had in 2018? What have you added the rolls and the biscuits and, you know, all those other forms we eat bread in? We have no idea, right? I mean, you know, it doesn't make a big impact on us. You know, if I might ask, you know, how many times have you eaten lobster in 2018 or something like that? And probably most of you know, maybe all of, many of you are like me, not a single time, ever in my life, I don't think. It's expensive. But you know, bread is just kind of one of those things you just eat. And you might have a hard time sometimes telling how much you'd eaten that day. Let alone for your whole year. So these people these wicked people are devouring God's people as nonchalantly, as indifferently as they eat bread. In Micah chapter 3, Micah uses that same expression, that same idea as to how they eat up my people. In Micah 3 and verse 1, he said, "And I said, hear now, heads of Jacob and rulers of the house of Israel, is it not for you to know justice? You who hate good and love evil, who tear off their skin from them and their flesh from their bones, who eat the flesh of my people, strip off their skin from them, break their bones and chop them up as for the pot and as meat in a kettle." That's pretty vicious. You know, they're taking God's people and they're chopping them up and boiling them and eating them. Now, I don't know that that means literally they eat them, but they exploit them, they persecute them, they afflict them, they take advantage of them. It's like they chop them up and eat them. And you can think about times in the Bible where the wicked people have done all manner of violence against God's people, verbally and otherwise. What a foolish thing for wicked people to do. Do they realize who they're messing with? You know, they do this as if it's no big deal to oppress God's people. You know, they do it with as little guilt as they eat their food, as they eat their bread. It's easy for all of us sometimes to do wicked things and not really think seriously about it. For it to just kind of become normal, natural, second nature to us, and it doesn't really bother us. It's easy for us to bite and devour one another. Galatians talks about that, where Christians can be at each other's throats and to seek to hurt each other and put each other down and do violence toward each other. You know, it's the workers of wickedness that eat up God's people as they eat bread. Is that where we're at? Which side of the coin are we on? He says they do not call upon the Lord. Their lack of prayer, their lack of turning to God is a sure mark of their being wicked. You can tell a wicked person because he doesn't turn to God. He doesn't pray to God. He doesn't care about God. You know, he tries to do everything on his own. He thinks he's strong enough, big enough, tough enough, or smart enough to handle it by himself. So these workers of wickedness eat up my people as they eat bread, and they don't call on the Lord. How does that work out for them? Verse 5. There they are in great dread, for God is with the righteous generation. You would put to shame the counsel of the afflicted, but the Lord is his refuge. That right there, where they're trying to eat up God's people, where they're trying to afflict and oppress them, they're in great dread. They're terrified. There, where they thought they had the upper hand, where they thought everything was going well for them, suddenly they're panic-stricken as God turns to protect his people and to punish their enemies. It's easy for wicked people to become overconfident when they think they've got the upper hand on God's people. It reminds me a little bit of 2 Kings chapter 6. You remember how Elisha and his servant have been surrounded by the armies of the Arameans. And the servant is terrified. And Elisha says in 2 Kings 6:16, "Do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." Then Elisha prayed and said, "O Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see." And the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. Sometimes that's not what we see. We're kind of like that servant. We don't realize that the Lord's got his horses and chariots of fire surrounding his people. We only see the enemy, and we don't realize what they're up against. In the long run, they'll find out it's dangerous to mess with God's people. That's not something you want to do if you're a wicked person, because you're going to be in great dread and terror. They're trying to put to shame the counsel of the afflicted, but God is his refuge. God will bring them down. No matter what the attacks are, no matter how bad the oppression is, God is the shelter, he's the refuge for those who are with him. We need to turn to the Lord in times of trouble and rely on him and realize he is our protection. So it's easy for us to feel overwhelmed that when we are in a wicked world, when there are people against us, when wicked people turn on us, they put us down verbally, they may try to hurt us in other ways, it's easy to become discouraged. But God is our refuge, and he will turn the tables. And then the last verse of this psalm moves beyond that. He says, oh, that the salvation of Israel would come out of Zion. When the Lord restores his captive people, Jacob will rejoice, Israel will be glad. Here's the longing for something beyond what they have right now. David is writing this. And David's looking forward to the salvation coming out of Israel. God told David that one of his descendants would establish the everlasting kingdom. That's going to be the saving factor for the whole nation. They're longing for the Messiah. They're longing for the Lord to come and to bless them. And really, this prayer that salvation would come out of Israel is answered by God in a greater way than even David would have imagined. You think about what a tremendous salvation came in response to what David asked for. When the Lord restores his captive people, that phrase, restoring his captive people, is sometimes misunderstood. Sometimes you think about captive people and you think about maybe, well, they went into captivity and they're brought back. Well, that's a fair application of that, but it's not the only one. In Job 42:10, just a few pages back, the same expression is used, the Lord restored the fortunes of Job. Well, Job wasn't really in captivity, but he really had a, you know, terrible catastrophe. Many of them occurred to him, and God blessed him again. Restoring the captivity, restoring the fortunes, is just saying when God blesses his people again, any deliverance and restoration fits that category. So really, when the Lord restores his captive people is really what he's done for us. The Messiah came out of Zion and restored us, blessed us to come back to the Lord, gave us a whole new outlook on life. Jacob will rejoice. Israel will be glad. God's people should today rejoice and be glad for the wonderful deliverance and salvation that God has provided. So it's a brief psalm, but in it we see how foolish it is to deny God, at least in our actions, and how really all of us have been there. By God's grace, some of us are redeemed, and the workers of iniquity turn against us and try to devour us. They refuse to turn to the Lord, but the tables will be turned, they'll be brought down, and one day David prays that the salvation would come that would completely reverse the fortunes, and then his people would rejoice, and we are in that era. We have been blessed in that way. Really a very complete psalm for seven verses. I'd like for us to reread it, and then we'll stand and sing. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have committed abominable deeds. There is no one who does good. The Lord has looked down from heaven upon the sons of men to see if there are any who understand, who seek after God. They've all turned aside. Together they have become corrupt. There is no one who does good, not even one. Do all the workers of wickedness not know, who eat up my people as they eat bread, and do not call upon the Lord? There they are in great dread, for God is with the righteous generation. You would put to shame the counsel of the afflicted, but the Lord is his refuge. Oh, that the salvation of Israel would come out of Zion when the Lord restores his captive people. Jacob will rejoice. Israel will be glad. Let's stand.